Hey, everybody. Welcome to In Context. Happy Memorial Day. Usually I say Happy Monday, but this is actually something to be happy about. It's a holiday, meaning most of you aren't at work and you're out there enjoying the sunshine. Hopefully you're listening to us, getting your news as well. This is the last Monday of the month, and the heck was that?
That was my cell phone, sorry.
please, in the audience, turn your cell phones on silent, like as they say in church.
Please put your cell phones on vibrate.
This is In Context, and this is the last Monday of the month, so this is our monthly war report, and you can learn more about us at incontextreport.com, and you can visit our YouTube page as well at youtube.com/incontextreport. And you can find us on Facebook and like us and get updates to the show and announcements of what's coming up and announcements when we upload the podcast of the previous show and any other articles we may find along the way and repost and share so that you can get them out to your friends out there. And so I am your host, Gus Cantavero, along with my fellow co-host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and behind the board, Marshawn.
Good afternoon. Happy Memorial Day.
Military affairs commentator and also board operator and phone screener and everything else.
I'm all purpose.
Driver in the car and right here.
Okay. Thanks for joining us, folks. We're with you every Monday from noon until 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month. And the last Monday of the month, as Gus mentioned, we give the war report. And over the last several months, we've been focusing quite a bit on the Mideast. And let's get started today, Marshawn, with Syria. Some interesting developments there just in this month. DEBCA, the Israeli Intelligence News Service, stated that the U.S. allies, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, were behind a huge terror attack which demolished a Syrian command center in Damascus, killing a large number of people. And DEBCA also reported that there are 12,000 U.S. and allied commandos preparing to conduct military exercises in Jordan along the Syrian border. Okay, Marshawn, what do you make of these developments?
Well, I mean, I think this is what's happening now in Syria. Is there's, as we've known for a while, a covert war going on between the forces of NATO, the U.S., and those of Assad, Russia, and China.
And, of course, we know that, and that's what we've been stressing on our show, if I could just interject. The rest of the corporate media is presenting it as a much different picture.
Exactly. But I think one of the interesting developments is you're seeing with this bombing that the rebels, particularly the U.S.-backed forces, have upped the ante. They've committed a lot more strength and effort behind their attacks. They've redoubled their efforts. And it also, part of it's a propaganda effort for the rebels to show we can hit the government heartland. You know, because originally we'd believe that the rebels were finally being pushed out. Another thing, though, is the reason why we're putting special forces on the border in Jordan is because we're preparing for a ground war in Syria. But the main focus of the ground war is not actually going to be Syria itself. The main focus of the ground war is going to be Iran. But what we figure is that once we cut Iran off, once we cut Syria off from Iran, then we'll effectively cut off al-Assad's means of support. We'll cut him off from the Iranians and the Russians, and then his government will just collapse. Because fundamentally, the only thing propping up his military is its support from the Iranian Quds force and the Russian Speznaz.
And to step back a moment, as we've mentioned several times in the show, Wesley Clark gave a famous interview with Amy Goodman several years ago, in which he revealed that he saw a report at the Pentagon coming out of the office of the Secretary of Defense. This is back just a few weeks after 9/11. And in this memo, the Defense Department stated that it was going to take over seven countries, naming among them Libya, Syria, and culminating, General Clark said, with Iran, which of course is the great prize because Iran has the greatest combined oil and natural gas reserves in the world. I think Russia may be close, but beyond that, Iran is the greatest prize.
Not just that, but I mean, taking out Iran for the United States is as important as taking out Israel is for the Russians. Iran is Russia's forward operating base in the Middle East. If we take out Iran, we have full spectrum dominance at that point over the entire Middle East. Iran is what gives the Russians a foothold in the Middle East. And this goes back to really probably the 19th century.
Oh, Catherine the Great was always trying to push south. The Russian Emperor
exactly. Peter the Great tried to do the same thing. And in fact, the Russians and the Brits fought wars over it. I mean, fundamentally, that's what the Crimean War was about, was control over the Middle East. because it would liberate the Russian Black Sea fleet. And also, additionally, it was the Russians had made a couple attempts to invade Iran, and the Shah's forces had pushed them back. But now the tables are turned. Iran, which was traditionally not a Russian ally, is now a Russian ally.
Yes, it's ironic. We forced them into the arms of Russia. And, of course, the corporate media is always portraying Russia now. It's kind of an annoyance. They don't understand what's really going on. But if, in order for our audience to really understand what's going on is to know that there is a mutual defense treaty between Iran and Russia, that Russia has been for many years a very staunch ally of Syria. So
oh,
we
absolutely.
Go after well, these two countries,
more
we're going
than
after
just,
Russia.
More than just being a staunch ally, Russia has sent in its elite SOBR police special forces units to Damascus. Again, this was covered in DEBCA, the Israeli intelligence agency. Additionally, the Russians have shipped in naval Spetsnaz. That was covered in Haaretz. That was covered in Russia Today. The Russians have a fleet in the Syrian port of Tartus. So this is more than just a Russian ally. The fact is that Syria has Russian troops there.
And we're seeing played out in Syria, to some extent, what played out in Libya, especially with the use of al-Qaeda. Debka reported that Libyan al-Qaeda fighters, the same people who helped us overthrow Gaddafi, were flown in by Qatar into the border area of Syria, Turkey-Syria, one assumes to be part of this supposedly indigenous resistance, but is actually being fueled by outside terrorists. And Webster Tarpley, we saw an interview with him. He came back from a visit to Syria late last year, where he said what he observed was terrorists shooting at civilians, just targeting them in order to create mayhem and in order to provoke the Syrian army to retaliate. And in the retaliation, of course, they killed more civilians.
One of the journalists who was shot, I think his last name is Nazim Roya. Nazim Roya was the one who reported on it. He was being shot at. He did not get hit. There was another journalist. I can't remember what agency he was from. I think he was from France. And he was shot in the leg while out on a bicycle just touring the city square. He was shot from a rooftop. And he was just out there just taking a look. And he got shot in the leg. And then Nazim Roya was up there on a rooftop. I think he was putting... what was this in Libya? Oh, I think I'm mixing stories. It's all blending together now.
Journalists getting shot.
The point is that it's the same tactic done in each of the countries, Libya and Syria. Now it's the exact same thing where the terrorists are coming in and shooting innocent people to make it look like the government is shooting distrust.
This is a very old tactic, too. This was a tactic used, predominantly used by the Viet Cong during the Vietnam War. They'd go into a South Vietnamese village, kill everyone, and then all of their propaganda outlets would say, oh, see, the Americans did this. The Americans murdered all these people. And, you know, investigators would come in and realize, well, that the babies had their heads stepped on. Well, it was a sandal print, not a boot print, you know, kind of a thing.
So this is the old false flag thing.
It's a very old tactic, is to massacre a group of people and blame it on your opponents. And we learn from the Viet Cong. We learn some of their dirty tricks.
So now the UN is saying that something's got to be done about Assad. The British and the French and the U.S. are, of course, blaming Assad for all this killing, a horrible massacre at Hula, which occurred 2 days ago. Over 100 civilians are said to be dead.
Right.
And, of course, the West is immediately saying this was done by Assad. Assad released a statement saying that his troops were attacked by terrorists and then they were responding.
And the Russians right now are blaming the opposition. In fact, actually, there's an article here in Russia Today where Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, says both parties are guilty in the Hula massacre. But I think it's worth noting that the Syrian government has not withdrawn from the peace process. The rebels, the opposition, have withdrawn from the peace process. In fact, the first people to break the peace, the brokered peace agreement, has been the Syrian rebels.
It's extremely cynical because as the West funds terrorism in Syria, they're at the same time calling at the UN for intervention on humanitarian grounds. We saw this in Libya.
Yeah, and who are the people who news outlets like CNN are putting on for the people to hear? It's these guys who have close ties with the rebels who are saying, give us our independence, you know, help liberate us, like guys like Syria Danny,
sure,
who are from London and connected to, you know, the intelligence network. They send him out to Syria so he can produce these fake videos where they set off bombs in the background or shoot guns in the side of the camera so that it sounds like he's in the middle of a war zone.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
They staged the whole thing?
Completely staged.
I remember watching one of those
TV, or was it Al Jazeera? I think it was Press TV. They got a hold of... the actual clip. So it was unedited. And it was him standing in front of the camera with the earpiece and a microphone. Or he's holding a cell phone because he's waiting for CNN to go live. He's off to the side, and the guy, and he's like, man, it's freaking cold out here. And you hear like a bomb in the background. He doesn't even flinch. And he's like, just start firing as soon as we go live. And he looks off to the side.
And we've seen this pattern with Iraq before we invaded Iraq. The Iraqi National Congress, we financed these groups. We set them up in a foreign country. We create this kind of government in exile, which is going to be our puppet once we take over. Now, the United States has been putting out this news story through outlets like the New York Times. I heard it on NPR, which is that we may convince Russia to agree to overthrow the Assad government.
Is
this wishful thinking, or is there anything to this, that the Russians may have decided that there's some way of defusing the situation?
That is insane naivete. Part of it is because – part of it's to convince the American people that, no, we're not – pushing the Russians towards a war. Like, what we've been saying is you know, our military adventurism might push Russia to war with the United States. The fact is, though, is that what the government then has to do is say, well, you know, maybe refute what we're saying and other journalists like us are saying. You know, the Russians really are not our enemies. First, it's the Russians are weak. The Russians are – they can't do anything. Their military is antiquated. Well, then when that becomes self-evident that their military is not antiquated, their Sukhoi T-50 is better than RF-22 stealth fighter.
Okay, in more detail. That's really important. Well, what's a Sukhoi?
It's a Russian stealth fighter bomber. But point I'm trying to get to is not that, because I'll get into that later.
Yeah.
The point that I'm trying to get to is when we realize that they have military equipment equal to ours, then so we can't do that. We can't say that they are antiquated. So now we have to say, well, maybe they're not really our enemies. Maybe we can pretend that they're our friends. So part of it, I think, is on the one hand trying to delude the American people, and then on the other hand, it's self-delusion. I mean, President Obama was the man who said, you know, we have to build closer ties with Russia and China because they're our friends and they want to work with us. And you have to be high. I mean, you literally have to be stoned out of your mind.
Because our foreign policy since the end of the Cold War has been geared towards global hegemony, and the targets are Russia and China.
Well, not just that, but, you know, they've always wanted to be imperial powers. And so it's self-evident. It should be self-evident to these supposed politicians, people who have degrees, you know, PhDs and whatnot. It should be self-evident to them that the Russians and the Chinese have always wanted to be imperial powers. And if we keep pushing them, eventually, historical fact, empires collide. The reason why the Russians and the Brits fought, the reason why the Brits and the French fought, the reason why the Brits, the French, and the Germans and the Russians all fought, it was all because when one nation becomes imperialistic, starts to dominate the world, other people want to get in the action. And then when that one empire, like the British Empire before World War I, begins to get weak, the other empires pounce on them.
Yeah, they look for that moment of weakness to be able to go and undercut their legs.
Exactly. And we are just radiating that air of military weakness.
It's the old empire game, you know, and as the famous
What did the Americans do to the Spanish, you know, the Philippines?
Sure.
And we looked at a moment where the Spanish were weak. We went in and we saw the moment to strike, and we took them out.
And we're following the trajectory of the Spanish Empire and the British Empire. We're corroding from within. Our economy is getting hollowed out as we devote more and more of our resources to warfare.
But I think the big question we need to ask is the next major war. Is it going to be a war like for the Spanish? Because the Spanish-American War, the Spanish lost a lot of people. They lost a lot of ships. But the war ultimately didn't hit Spanish shores.
No.
But
well, their empire had been shot a long time before.
Yeah, but the question is,
it just cost them a lot of money.
Yeah.
Exactly. The question is if we go to war, because Syria ultimately is going to be a second front, the big issue is going to be the war with Iran. And if we go to war with Iran – Is it going to escalate? A, is it going to cost a million American lives overseas? And worse still, if it drags in the Russians and the Chinese, because the Chinese have a mutual defense treaty with the Russians, if it drags them in as well, could we potentially see bombs landing on American cities? And I think that's something we really need to be cognizant of.
Well, you bring up Iran, which, of course, is the great prize, a serious kind of a second front that we're trying to take care of. And in this regard, Debka also reported that for the first time, the Iranian army is starting a two-day practice of drills of offensive tactics involving dropping large numbers of paratroopers behind enemy lines. Now, past Iran exercises have focused on defensive strategies against repelling, presumably, a U.S. and allied invasion. And so where would Iran use these paratroopers? What could be a possible scenario for a war in which Iran went on the offensive?
I think Iran's encouraged to go on the offensive in part because of the intelligence it's receiving from the Russians, promises of military aid, the fact that the Russians have shipped in troops and surface-to-air missile systems into Iran. And, of course, the help from the Chinese. But I think one of the things that the Iranians are seeing is that we have shrunk and are continuing to shrink our military so woefully that if they launch a ground offensive, particularly they drop paratroopers behind our lines in Saudi Arabia, especially in the Shia-majority areas like in Qatif in the east of Saudi Arabia where all the oil wells are, we won't have the manpower for extended operations there. We rely entirely on our air power. So if they take the fight to us, if they drop paratroopers outside our military installations, if they drop paratroopers behind our military installations, we won't have the manpower to repel that, plus if they start sending armored units through the desert, plus if they have air support.
Well, would they intend to this to be saboteurs? Like guerrilla war?
To an extent, it might be in places like Syria, but I think what we're looking at is a Normandy-like scenario where during D-Day, the Americans dropped, it was thousands and thousands of paratroopers behind enemy lines while the ground assault commenced on the beaches. And the reason is it's to
create two-front war.
Almost like a 3-4-front war because you're fighting in so many, because now these pockets of paratroopers are securing certain objectives, bridges, roads, barracks, small towns.
Would they
be
successfully able to fly troop carriers through our air defense?
I think so, largely because what it would require is in the first 24 hours of the fight, the Americans, we would launch a massive air campaign. Now, none of our aircraft, even our F-22s, which pilots have now said they refuse to fly because of technical issues,
yeah,
the F-22 has never been tested in combat. When these bombers fly over, the Iranians have Russian S-300 and now the new S-400 surface-to-air missile system. If they shoot down our aircraft, the key would be they shoot down our aircraft, then the Iranians launch a counterattack with missiles and aircraft of their own, hit our air bases, hit our ships in the Persian Gulf, which are incredibly vulnerable to the Iranian Qader missile. This is an aircraft carrier killer. It was developed by the Chinese aeronautics industry. It's almost undetectable. It flies just below radar, but just, you know, above the water, so it can't be picked up by sonar. If they hit our fleet, if they knocked out our aircraft, they could achieve air superiority probably within the first 48 hours. Mm. And in which case, then they could successfully drop paratroopers.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context, a political talk show on WPKN 89.5, streaming at WPKN.org. We'll be giving a phone number out shortly. Do you want to give it out now, Gus? Or?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, our phone number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. If you want to join our conversation about the developing situation in the Mideast, we're very concerned, as we have been for all year on In Context, about the prospect of a wider war in the Mideast, perhaps bring us into direct confrontation with Russia. So if you'd like to join the discussion, tell us what you think on this Memorial Day. It would be nice if we're talking about peace. But unfortunately, the world is poised on the edge of an ever wider war. You can also drop us an email at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org, and we'll read your question, your comment online.
I just want to make a comment. I think that first, Leon Panetta, this is not just our rumors and, you know, insinuation here. Leon Panetta did say yesterday that they're ready to intervene in Iran, should they get the order to go, and that Iran has enough uranium to build multiple warheads, and they're making two nuclear plants, and whether this is true or not, we have no idea, because this is all based off of fraudulent IAEA reports, which have been shown to be wrong in the past, and it's just rehashed information from 8 years ago.
It's like weapons of mass destruction
all over
again.
That was proven to be inaccurate before. Yeah. And it's based on, you know, these intercepted laptops that were proven to be fraudulent as well. Anyway, I wonder if we did escalate to a new war with Iran and, of course, Russia and China on the periphery, if not on a full frontal. Russia is much more vocal about their technology, I think, for public consumption in order to prove their dominance and to frighten people. America is incredibly secretive about its technology, and it still pretends that the the Blackbird is the fastest jet that they have, and that plane was built 40 years ago.
Well, and I think that's one of the problems.
That can't be still true.
Well, no, I think one of the big problems that we have is that we the well it, it's it, there's a couple different ways of looking at it. The Russians let out all of their military, well, many of their military secrets. I mean, I'm sure they have technology that they don't tell us.
Yeah.
But they let out much of the military secrets for public consumption to, you know, intimidate their
enemies.
Like
their new missile test that they did just a few days ago in order to bypass the missile shield, just to prove we are not susceptible to this, you know.
Exactly. And then, but then on the other hand, the Americans have the mentality that, well, we're not going to tell anybody. We're going to have the big secrets. But the problem is you're only keeping the secrets from the American people because the Russians and the Chinese have spies
they know.
Everywhere.
Okay. All right. Good,
you know, so
good point.
They know what we're capable of. The only problem is the American people don't. But it works great because the average American is completely unaware that most of our combat systems have never been tested in combat, that we don't have enough troops to fight a ground war, that we, you know, our drones are utterly useless in a conventional war. But the American people can't wrap their minds around this.
Why is that? There's been a lot of talk about drones. We're using them all the time now in Pakistan, Afghanistan, in Yemen now, I think perhaps Somalia. Why are drones not going to be useful?
In a guerrilla war, they're very useful because the enemy doesn't have things like man-portable surface-to-air missile systems. They don't have – I mean, even if you look at – there's a Cold War weapon that I'm trying to remember what it's called. But it's basically like a tank. It's got a turret on it. It's got these big machine guns on it, these big like anti-aircraft machine guns. And the name will come to me in a minute. And those things could just bring down the drones easily because drones – they can fly high, but they can't fly high enough to not be man visible. Mm-hmm. So they could be shot down with very rudimentary anti-aircraft technology, or even, you know, you're talking a country that has aircraft, a country that has things like radar. They could bring it down with their own aircraft. They could bring it down with their own helicopters. These things are great for spying on Americans, and they're great for watching the border, and they're great for spying on insurgents who can't shoot you down. But when it comes to a conventional war where somebody else has the same military technology, I think part of the problem, and this is, again, something the American people have to really wrap their mind around, is that we haven't fought somebody with the same military capabilities as us since the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. And also, everything's controlled by satellites, right?
Exactly.
Which the satellites can be spoofed, and satellites can be hacked, and satellites can be shot down.
Exactly. And if we lose control of our satellites through any of those means, whether it's the Russians also and the Chinese developed a missile called the satellite killer. It's not a missile. It's a suicide satellite. The thing floats around space looking like it's a television satellite. And then on a command, it'll careen itself into an American satellite. The brilliance of this is that if you knock out our satellites, we lose all command and control on the battlefield because generals have gotten further from the battlefield than ever before. They've gotten – and I actually did a research paper when I was in college on this very subject. And one of the problems is that generals are so removed – and not just generals but all staff officers.
This is what you call command and control.
Exactly. It would allow commanders to command and control their men on the battlefield. They've become so removed because everything is done through computers. What happens now is a guy sits in front of a computer, a staff officer, and he looks at his battalion, and it's the battalion all have little GPS chips inside their Humvees, inside their vehicles, so now he can see where they are, and he directs them that way. And then they say, well, we need artillery support. He goes, okay, well, you know, call it in this grid coordinates. All right. Boom, plots it on the computer and everything.
He could be sitting in Kuwait or Qatar or something.
Exactly. He could be sitting in Washington.
Right. Yeah, Pentagon.
But the problem is that the moment those satellites are knocked out, this general suddenly has no clue what's going on.
Right.
All of our communications go down. Guys don't plot coordinates anymore on maps. They use what are called dagger systems and a Blue Force tracker. And again, this is all open source, by the way. And these are basically GPS, little handheld GPS devices or GPS devices that you put inside the Humvees or the tanks. And
Blue Force being our friendlies and Red Force being enemy, right?
Kind of, yeah.
That's always that red team, blue team. That's why they always run it, don't it?
I'm not exactly sure. I believe so. It's kind of the idea behind it.
Yeah, okay.
But the idea is that it allows you to communicate with everybody in the entire battle space and allows you to see where everybody in your battle space is. Again, if that goes out because they've taken down our satellites, there's complete chaos because guys don't know how to plot this stuff on maps anymore. It's the Iranians, on the other hand, the Russians and the Chinese can operate low tech in the sense that they all still train how to use maps. They don't use GPS.
We seem to be relying on a war, and we're evidently amassing F-15s and F-22s. We're relying on high technology, on air warfare, on our naval armada, and we're pretty much figuring that we don't need a large ground force. Is that right?
In a nutshell, and again, that's going to be a huge mistake, because how many times in human history has it happened where they say the war will be over by Christmas?
Yeah, you know? But you can't just blow up an entire country.
No, and all bombing them does is stiffen their resolve. The only tactic that works when it comes to defeating a foreign country on the battlefield is to destroy their army and occupy their country with a million men. Let's face it, whether the rights or wrongs of it, the fact is that military history, the only tactic that has worked to defeat a foreign country has been to occupy them and just inundate them with troops, destroy their military on the battlefield and then inundate their country with troops.
And in the Middle East, that really doesn't work very well because there's so much desert. It's not like in France where you could just occupy the cities and then just roam the countryside once in a while and confiscate their cheese.
Yeah.
It's different. This is the desert where there's caves and caverns and rocks.
And Iran especially is incredibly, goes from desert to just incredibly mountainous.
Yeah, it's impossible to occupy a country. I mean, look, Afghanistan is a failure because it's unoccupiable.
And we also, again, we're using, I mean, I think the situation in Afghanistan might be a little different if we went in with 1.5 million men, you know.
But that would have to be the only goal. You can't be looking at regional hegemony going from nation to nation. It's impossible.
Yeah, right. There's not enough resources.
There aren't even enough people in the United States to occupy the Middle East.
And then someone has to say, geez, couldn't the American public's money and couldn't our young men and women be used for something more useful?
maybe.
Exactly. I mean, the fact is that the way we're going about it, whether rightly or wrongly, the way we're going about it is, from a strategic perspective, incredibly dumb.
You know,
there is no historical precedence for this ever working.
Well, I mean, the thing that worries me, I mentioned future technology before, is that because Syria is a coastal region, we can bring battleships with the new railgun systems or something on there and just start practicing with our new long-distance, you know, light beam technology or satellite-based missile platforms or something. That's what I'm really deathly afraid of.
That's entirely possible. But again, one thing we haven't counted on is the intervention of the Russians or the Chinese.
Well, that's what makes it different from Libya, right?
Well, much different is that, you know, Gaddafi was he was a despot. He was hated. But the Russians were willing to see him go because they knew Syria was next. They knew they had to draw the line in the sand at some
point. And Libya actually had some pretty interesting technology, like tank-busting weapons, except that they never had the ability to get in the air. Everything
exactly.
that they did had to be done from the ground.
That's right.
And with a coordinated NATO bombing campaign around the clock of a multiple nations jet fleets, it's impossible to fight back against that by yourself.
Exactly. But that's why what makes...
And it still lasted a long time.
Oh, yeah. And that's what makes this different with Syria and with Iran, is that the Russians and the Chinese will come to their aid if we launch a full-scale war. And the Russians have, you know, technology they developed in the 70s and they've only been perfecting since, like the Typhoon-class submarine, which uses underwater jet propulsion, was actually the inspiration for the Hunt for Red October. This jet propulsion system is silent drive. It runs completely silent underneath the ocean. And something we haven't been investing
in. So you mean them defecting to the United States didn't help?
No, not at all. No. Sean Connery's coming over to our side didn't change it, unfortunately.
Oh, that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, I know. But he did get a knighthood, though.
It dashed my hopes.
But the fact is that with this technology, they have the capability of striking at our fleet. So great, we got these rail guns that can, you know, hit halfway around the world. Well,
yeah,
the Russians can sink it.
There's a countermeasure for everything.
Exactly. And the problem is that none of our technology has been tested in the battlefield against an army that can match ours.
Which is why we really want another war, so we can get this stuff tested. Yeah.
How do you think this is going to play out? It looks like, to me, that we were going to – that conquering Syria – was a prerequisite to attacking Iran. Now I'm wondering, is it going to be sufficient for U.S. military objectives just to create chaos in Syria so the government's paralyzed by terrorism? And do we have a phone call?
Yeah, you got to answer the phone.
Very good. I mean, that's what it seems to me that was the first take out Syria. Now maybe it's enough to paralyze Syria. Now I'm wondering, are there going to be simultaneous attacks on Syria and Iran with this 12,000-man commando force on the Syrian border?
I think that the Americans would really like to keep it nice and neat and tidy and go from one neighborhood to the next, i.e. Libya to Syria, then to Iran.
Right.
But I don't think that the opposition is going to allow it to go so neatly. And I'm wondering, because it would just be a complete blunder. I mean, they're next, right? And I think that it's almost silly that they didn't intervene in Libya to help the other side and just get the war going. But it could
you
be.
You mean that Russia didn't intervene?
Exactly.
Yeah, Pakistan.
And I think it's because maybe they felt like being too spread out would work against them and
yes.
that they would rather wait for us to get to Syria so that everything could stay contained in one
right.
region instead of having to go across the Mediterranean.
Yes.
Exactly. And I think a lot of it has to do, too, with the. You force us into this bottleneck area. And then, of course, now
right.
we can't topple Assad. So what we have to do, and I think the strategy now is. Excuse me, we invade Iran, we'll basically cut off the head of the viper, and Assad's government will fall without Iran's support.
So you're inclined to the view that we don't have to, at this point, our leaders may have decided they don't have to take out the Syrian government first before they attack Iran.
No, because I think it's become evident to them that we can't take out the Syrian government so long as Iran is standing. And so the problem is this spreads us out immensely, but more than anything, if it doesn't work, if the offensive against Iran doesn't work, then we end up fighting a three-fronted war, Syria, Iran, and Lebanon.
I think that would be pretty tough for us.
Let's take the call, but I want to get on to Israel's position here after
sure.
this.
Absolutely. This is Jeff from Bridgeport. Go ahead, Jeff. You're
Hi,
on
Jeff.
The air with WPKN.
I really appreciate this radio station and your reports. And
thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
It's so discouraging to be a part of this country. It seems we've forgotten all of our principles, and you know, to hear a little bit of truth, which is very clear that it is, because it just reveals all the things you hear in little bits and pieces.
In your words, what would the principles be that this country's founded on? What we should be standing for? What you think we stand for?
Self-determination,
mm-hmm.
freedom,
mm-hmm.
Honesty, some kind of fair due process for common people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in the Middle East, our objectives are completely different from the people who are there. I mean, I think they are looking for their own self-determination, so that is a common sort of thing, but their whole culture is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the side that we identify as terrorist is actually the side which is the revolution, and they're looking for a strong Islamic state,
mm-hmm.
strong Islamic states. I think that's what the what's the term for Al Qaeda? Doesn't that mean spring for Islam or something?
It's soldiers of God, isn't it?
So, to that effect, yes.
Yeah. But wouldn't you say that maybe the reason why there isn't widespread popular support for these revolutions in the Middle East is because the average people don't feel represented by really either side, the standing establishment governments or these really fundamentalist revolutions? I mean, we're sort of putting our nose under the tent, trying to give them a revolution when perhaps they're not ready or they don't like what this revolution stands for.
Not only that, our idea of a revolution is we just all in the United States, we tend to easily just think, oh, well, it's a repeat of the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm,
it's completely
mm-hmm.
different. And there are so many different sects of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a general agreement. You know, it's easy to say we want to throw off the repressive regime here, which...
But what are we replacing it with?
And is there agreement among the different groups?
Right.
So with the situation, for instance, in Egypt, you have the revolution supposedly succeeding, and then the army takes over.
Right.
Or continues in its position of power, just shifting slightly away from
from Mubarak.
Mubarak's. I'm forgetting the word.
That's okay.
Okay, so there is no happy story.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Americans imagine. Oh well, that's great. The revolution is succeeding, and we're on their side. I don't think we're really on their side. Americans are, really. I think most Americans have a very simple idea of what democracy means, and it's nothing like the idea of Islamic revolution.
All right, well, thank you very much for the call.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
Oh, I just wanted to mention one other thing.
Go ahead.
When the thing that I would like to see Americans get behind is the idea that we don't need to get into wars in foreign countries at all anymore. We have never interceded in the last 50 years in a helpful way, unless you want to look at a very distorted presentation of it, like Grenada or something, which
I agreed.
Would be ridiculous. We go into Iraq, and immediately we take out 600,000 people, which just is completely in agreement with the figures the Army gave, with their dropping 300,000 ordnance with a likely, kill for each one of 2 to 3 accidental innocent bystanders.
Right.
So we're worried about 100 people? Really?
Yeah. That's disingenuous.
Just shipping our guys over there. Mm-hmm. Accident.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Jeff. We really appreciate it. Have a happy Memorial Day. And I think Jeff, said a lot of words that need to be said on Memorial Day about America's values, self-determination, freedom, honesty, due process. These are the things that we really should be standing for.
And self-determination doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to choose to live the way we want to live.
Right.
I mean, I think that's something that I think shows the provincial attitude that America's leaders have, is the notion that, okay, we're going to go into Afghanistan, we're going to give them Western democracy. Oh, how could the Iranians want to live in an Islamic republic? Well, who are we to say that they should live any other way? I mean, if let's say, for example, the Chinese were to show up here and say, you guys are going to live according to Mao Zedong thought, you're going to collectivization of everything, and, this is the best way to live, would we be happy? No.
I mean, we should understand one thing, I come from a very libertarian perspective, so I don't force my views on anybody, but we all need to understand that the form of government that you choose is very important to the kind of culture that you live in, right? So if you live in a very selfless society, a socialist type government could function very well as long as everybody is honest and really functioning for the good of the neighborhood. But in a melting pot society like America, you almost have to have a small government representative democracy.
I think that's a really good observation, Gus.
You really can't have something socialist in a place like America, because you have people, no one agrees with each other, and we self-segregate.
That's right.
And you can't force people, whites and blacks and Latinos and Asians, to want to stick up for each other, because the kind of culture that we have is very much an every man for himself
culture.
And also,
it is. And of course, that goes to private enterprise and free enterprise and private property, and everybody wants to have his own house and own car,
right,
which is fine.
That's fine.
People come to America.
But you all got to play by the same
rules.
For
economic opportunity. That's probably what unites us. That's why we're great at business. We're not great at empire, and we should get the heck out of the empire again.
Yeah, I mean, unless we want to – I mean, what we do with Empire, though, is that we turn it into a business opportunity.
Right, right.
We'll invade a country and then charge them rent to live there.
It's really – we have the world's most unique form of empire. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen an empire so heavily privatized. I mean, this doesn't mean that, no society ever goes to war. I mean, you do have wars. You do have, but the only reason to go to war should be for national defense. If we really think the Russians are going to come over here and take our livelihood or impose their way of living on us, then that's a justification for war. But building an empire, I mean, what has it gotten us?
And Jeff really put his finger on it. What are all these foreign wars about? They're not really an extension of American ideals or the will of the American people. And as you look back at our history, even really since the Spanish-American War, our foreign policy has been dominated and subservient to the interests of large corporations.
Mm-hmm. It's true, yeah. I mean, we really can't continue this effort. It's a completely backwards mind thought.
If you would like to join our conversation, you're listening to In Context at WPKN 89.5 FM, streaming at WPKN.org. We're on every Monday from noon to 1. We'll be with you for just another 15 minutes. So if you'd like to join this Memorial Day conversation about the current war situation around the world, give us a ring at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756, or you can drop us an email. Do you have the computer open there?
No, I can open it.
Okie dokie. You can drop us, if you'd rather not be on the air, just drop us a note to Ken at mdrtalk.org, and we'll read your question or your comment on the air.
I was also, before that call, I wanted to bring up Israel, since they are in such close proximity to Syria and Iran. It could be strategic that they were trying to bait us into a regional conflict there on the ground in Syria so that they could kind of hold Israel hostage. Since they're so close, they could drop a small size, you know, what are those things? What are they called? Frog? What are those small personal launcher? Oh, the Davy Crockett, you know, the Davy Crockett nuclear launcher? It's a two-man launched nuclear warhead. It's very small. And you could launch it from, I guess it's several miles away. By just a two-man team.
And who might launch this, you think?
I'm just throwing situations out there.
Yeah.
You know, perhaps if we're getting into a really tight regional conflict with a lot of loss, they could hold the ace up their sleeve is to hold Israel hostage by dropping a Davy Crockett onto Tel Aviv or something like that. What's going on here? Oh, okay. Thanks.
Yeah, and that's of course, Israel has one of the world's largest nuclear arsenals.
Yeah, but they wouldn't be able to detect an ICBM. This wouldn't be an ICBM. This is something that's launched from a hillside 10 miles away.
Right, but if somebody were using it in that region, whether Israel and other power, it could contaminate the whole region.
Yeah, I'm just saying maybe that's why they want to bring us into a tightly confined conflict, so that instead of getting into Libya, they bring us to their front door, hold Israel hostage.
Sure.
It also makes it strategically a lot easier for them to shuffle in reinforcements, because this way, I mean, if we're fighting in this tiny battle space, I mean, relatively tiny battle space, the Russians, I mean, they share a common border with the Iranians. They can ship in troops and supplies very readily. And then Syria is just a hop, skip, and a jump. But also, I think significantly, and we have a caller, and I want to get to him right away, but I just want to mention real quick, there's an article in Debka right now that just came out saying how a Russian ship has delivered heavy ammo to Syria, soon to be followed in the port of Tartus by the North Korean arms ship Odai. Mm-hmm. So
this just happened.
More Russian arms along with North Korean arms, which
and
I think
of course, as is a response to U.S. arms and Qatar, Saudi arms going to the Syrian, so-called Syrian rebels.
Yeah, and we've amassed a stealth jet armada near Iran as well, so we're definitely gearing up
so
for
things are really
the F-22. And this is Clayton from Maine. Go ahead, Clayton. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Clayton. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, you're welcome. First of all, the Russians are not going to risk getting involved in a confrontation with us. That's ridiculous.
And why not? Go ahead.
Well, first of all, why? Think about it. If the Russians are interested in empire building in the next century, in this century, if that's what they want to do, why would they start by getting involved in a conflict with the largest superpower in the world? That doesn't even make sense.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Did you hear the whole show?
Oh, yeah. I heard about 15, 20 minutes of it.
All right, because we started off the show with talking about waning empires in the end of their days and America undercutting Spain and the Philippines, taking them down, the lead-up to World War I with the fall of Britain, other countries seeing them as ripe for the picking. America is waning completely economically. We're on the verge of our own economic collapse, and this could be the opportunity for a country like Russia to be able to get rid of us as a nuisance and stop us from elbowing in on their space.
Yeah, Clayton, one of the things we talk about in the show are specific weapon systems Marchand has discussed that we seem to be overestimating our abilities.
Well, a lot of it, too, also, I mean, not just the weapon systems aside, but the Russians have formed a coalition. Really, it's an anti-U.S. coalition. The Russians share a mutual defense treaty with the Iranians, and they share a mutual defense treaty with the Chinese.
It's the opposite of NATO.
It's the Shanghai organization.
There's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, but that's something else. What I'm trying to get into is there's the
guys are overlooking a few things. For one thing, we could very safely get involved in a war with the Spanish Empire when we did. One, they didn't have nuclear weapons. Two, where we got involved is completely on the other side of the world. And three, the Spanish Empire had you say it was at the brink of crumbling. It had already crumbled. They had very little military control over any of those colonies.
Well, let's focus
and
on...
We just took them away from them.
On the military situation in Syria, for example.
Well, if I can, again, just backtrack. The issue that we encounter with, when it comes to the Russians and the Chinese, we both have nuclear weapons, but I think that's an incentive why we would keep, if there were going to be a conflict, we would keep it off of each other's native soil. But we might very well duke it out over Iran or Syria, only because whoever controls Iran and Syria ultimately will have full spectrum dominance of the Middle East, will have military dominance of the Middle East. It's the same reason why the Russians have actively worked to funnel arms to Hezbollah and Hamas, because they know if they can push Israel out of the Middle East, then they've effectively pushed the U.S. out of the Middle East. Now, I'm pretty sure both sides don't ultimately want a major war to occur in the Middle East, but it doesn't mean that the Russians or the Chinese will back down.
But it is happening, Marshawn. We know that the Russian special forces are in Syria fighting the rebels. We know that Obama recently ordered the third generation anti-tank missiles be made available to the Syrian forces.
The only reason the Russians have aided the Syrians is two causes. One, of course, Syria and Assad is an old ally of Russia. Two, they're hoping to beat us to the bit, so to speak. They figure that if they get men and material into Syria, that will cause us to hesitate and engage in Syria, which is, by the way, a very smart strategy. The thing is, though, they don't want to get involved in a conflict with us in the Middle East.
I agree with Clayton. I think they'd like to postpone the day of this conflict,
well,
but
Clayton,
they may not have much choice.
Clayton, let me ask you a question. Do you think that this is merely posturing? Or when you come to a conflict, obviously the Americans are ready to shoot. You know, we've proven that. Time and time
again. We've got the commandos on the border of Syria.
And we're ready to shoot. We're ready to go to war if someone wants to fight. I don't think that the Russians are cowards here, and that if they are going to posture, that they're going to be willing to respond in kind.
No. The Russians are not cowards. The Russians are the same people who beat the Germans, but guess what? So are we.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that.
Which means two rough heads coming together is going to pound. You know, they're going to hit.
Yeah, exactly. You don't. I mean, think about it. We spent 60 odd years avoiding confrontations with the Russians. They mm-hmm. spent 60 odd years
right.
avoiding confrontations with us.
So you think it's inevitable that we're just going to continue to avoid?
Yeah. What about the Russian alliance with Iran? Their mutual defense treaty. If we attract Iran, won't they respond?
Iran, don't get me wrong, Iran could be a tipping point because obviously we cannot allow Iran to have nuclear weapons. That can't happen. That changes our entire foreign uh-huh. policy position in the Middle East.
So you're saying it's not certain then?
It's not certain that we will never engage them, but Iran could be a tipping point just like Cuba almost was.
Okay.
I mean, the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think, can be related very easily to the situation in Iran, except for the fact Iran would shoot missiles at our ally in maybe European cities instead of missiles.
Well, it sounds like we're on the same page then.
And I think that's what the moral of what we were trying to get to ultimately was that Iran is the Cuban Missile Crisis of our modern day.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, like you also point out, there are a lot more players involved too, because we have the Israelis who are, you know, they have their finger on the button, they're ready to go. You have, you know, the Iranians have their finger on the button and they're ready to go. If either we or the Israelis bomb Iran, or Iran bombs one of our allies, or, you know, it escalates in that region.
There's a difference, though. The Cubans, the only major difference I see is this. The Cubans and their ideology were atheistic. They did not believe in supernatural events. There are lots of Muslims who do believe in supernatural events.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that it would be possible for them to unleash nuclear weapons without retaliation because mm-hmm. they think Allah would save them. Now, I don't think Ahmadinejad believes that. I think he's a politician just like our politicians. But the reason we can't let them have nukes is, one reason is, well, Ahmadinejad's not going to be there forever. Mm-hmm. Maybe a true religious zealot takes control in the next 10 years and, you know, they start shooting nukes.
Well, or the same thing could happen here and take
all of our nuclear weapons. We're the only ones that have used them.
True. And, you know, it could happen here. And, I mean, I would be opposed to us using nukes except in the most drastic cases of self-defense. My point is this, though. We need to learn the lesson of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the lesson of that was very simple. You go toe-to-toe with the Russians and their propped-up allies, and you dare them to push the button. That's what JFK did. And we got those missiles out of there.
Mm-hmm.
We do the exact same thing again with Iran. And as far as Syria is concerned, this is the thing. I hate to sound like a nationalist, but I don't really care what happens in Syria.
Well, neither do we.
That's their country. The only reason it involves us is that it might affect Israel. But other than that, who really cares what happens over there? And in all honesty, I think you see that opinion represented in our foreign policy. I don't think they really care what happens.
Clayton, thank you so much for your call. It's extremely stimulating. We appreciate your listening.
Call back anytime.
Thank you very much. And I think I locked that in.
We just have 5 minutes left, so if anyone wants to get a call in the last few minutes, give us a ring at 203-336-9756. You're listening to In Context, the political talk show on WPKN. It's 203- 336-9756, and we'll be with you for just another 5 minutes. We're on every Monday from noon to one.
You know, he said something important there where he said that he doesn't think that anyone our politicians really care what happens there, that it's mostly just sort of posturing. But what I see it as is a useful chess piece, that they keep it on the board and they keep the burner on simmer, you know, so that we can keep it in the forefront of the American mentality, so that we're always sort of conscious of what's happening in Syria.
Yeah.
So that when they're really ready to use it as use that piece, that people will already kind of understand what's going on.
Right.
There.
We're in a permanent state of war.
they're just building up that propaganda so that the people really do.
Anytime they want to say go,
The babies on incubators, propaganda, and everyone's ready to go.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, it's there. What do you think about the Israeli, when Israel might attack Iran? Because is this kind of a game that Obama is playing with the Israeli government?
Well, I mean, I definitely think that in order to keep this on boil, they have to constantly be shuffling it off to someone else's responsibility. So Obama can't be seen as the aggressor here. So he has to sort of share the responsibility of aggression with Israel. So Israel has to keep on coming out with these words of, we could attack any minute and we won't ask for your permission.
And Obama's basically saying, hold on.
Chill out, man.
Yeah, man, we're for peace. We have a caller?
We actually have two callers. We'll try to get to both of them. But this is Rick from New Haven. Go ahead, Rick. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Rick.
Hi. Your show is excellent. I've heard it before.
Thank you.
You said a key thing about 10 minutes ago that caused him to call in. When we go to other countries, a lot of people in the United States expect them to imitate our style of democracy or government or whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
That never happens, and I don't understand why more people don't understand that. I don't know if you remember a very creepy, vile woman from the United States named Lori Berenson who went to Peru and tried to overthrow their government, you know? I mean, this is just, it's colonialism.
Yeah, absolutely.
This country has no right, no one from this country has a right to go to any country and impose any kind of so-called American value on that country.
And the excuse is always that, well, it's because they're savages and they're not smart enough to be able to imitate our government, even though we gave them everything on a silver platter. But really, we just set them up for failure. We give them a form of government that's completely inconducive to their nature and give them a puppet of ours so that he's always making sure that everything that they do is subservient to our wishes.
In March 2003, I was an American citizen, but I was not living in the United States when the United States invaded Iraq. And I'm going to tell you, I could tell you a lot of stories, just facts about what happened outside this country when this country attacked Iraq.
I'm afraid we'll have to cut it short because we only have two more minutes.
Fine,
and we have one
show.
More caller coming on.
You have a great show.
Thank you very much.
And this next caller is Edward from New Haven. Go ahead, Edward. You're on the air with WPKN.
I think that's one of the most racist attitudes that I ever heard. Racist arrogance to claim that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon when Israel can have enough the weapons to obliterate the entire...
You think there's a double standard here, Edward?
Of course there's a double standard. Okay, and when you look at the history, Iran has never attacked any country within its entire history. How many countries has America attacked?
Yes.
How many countries has Israel attacked?
Isn't it kind of weird?
Israel bombed Tunisia. Israel bombed Iraq. Israel invaded Lebanon.
And Syria.
They have the audacity to call Iran a rogue nation.
Mm-hmm.
This is absurd. This is racist. Arrogant.
I completely 100% agree with your principle. I would just respectfully disagree that it's racist.
Well, why not? These are all darker nations, are they not?
Well, I mean,
why is it not racist?
I'm not saying it is or isn't. I'm not sure if it is. I mean, I think that there is a xenophobia.
But if you look
where people are afraid of other religions and cultures, I just don't know if it's racist against Iranians.
But apart from that, if you look at a map, we have armies all around Iran.
Oh, they're completely surrounded.
Missiles. We've invaded their neighbors, and Iran's the threat to world peace, right?
Yeah, and
I'm afraid we're actually going to have to cut this short.
I'm
afraid we're actually going to have to cut this short because we are
we have
to get off the air. So
thank you so much for calling,
Thank you so
Edward.
Very much for calling, Edward.
Yes, thank you.
All right, well...
Oh, and the website, incontextreport.com. Like us on Facebook, search In Context Report, and youtube.com/incontextreport. We will see you again
in
weeks?
In 2 weeks, and stay tuned for Rick Patron, who will be up next with the Sounds of Jazz.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Happy Memorial Day, everyone.
summer day. Huzzah, 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 huzzah for free America.